history, unity has never failed this great nation in time of war. Now we are facing an enemy without a face. A foe who is not on a radar screen, representing borderless nations that do not exist. They have unidentifiable weapons that are only stockpiled within the godlessness of twisted minds. This is no time for our enemies to live out their dreams within the hidden chambers of our own political system. The bravery that brought this nation to where we are is no longer adequate to take us to future generations. Because the forces of evil have never been so invisible, the price of greatness has never been so great. Fulfilling the dream of John F. Kennedy would require the hearts and minds of every citizen to team with our fighting men and women. Only then will we be united with one voice in saying, I do what I do for my country.
I grew up in the heartland. The folks I love are there. My sweetheart counts the days till I come back. While I'm out here in the desert, setting people free and making cowards pay for each attack.
Did you know that Pat Boone has sold over 45 million records? And he is in the top 10 best-selling musicians in the pop music history. He's ahead of Madonna. He's ahead of Billy Joel. Now, we've had Pat on in the past to promote his heavy metal CD and his R&B covers CD, but this time he joins us to tell us a little bit about a project more in line with his typical family values approach. As he puts it, Pat Boone, this is the Pat Boone America Knows Best. Pat has just released two new DVDs. One is called Thank You, Billy Graham, a musical tribute to the one man who changed our world with one message, long title. And the other is called For My Country, The History of the National Guard. You just heard a cut from that. Pat Boone, welcome back to the Bob Rivers Show. How are you?
Hello, Bob. Doing great. Good to talk to you again.
Wow, 45 million albums sold. You have started your own record label to showcase other artists.
Yeah.
And you you know, the point of view you just put forth there in that cut from For My Country is you know, clearly probably not the direction the country appears to be headed in the next election. You do know that, right?
Well, I understand the cross currents. Yeah, but the story is not finished yet. I think as the dust settles and we get down to two candidates and they begin to state their positions and so on. And of course, their one candidate has already been endorsed by Hamas, and the other has not.
And, true. And I love that.
We've got.
Did they actually endorse Obama?
We're Hamas, and we approve of this message.
Did they really?
They did, yes.
Or is that just rhetoric? Come on.
No. The leader of Hamas said, we like this man. We hope he'll be the next president.
Now, that could have positive connotations. Maybe we'd be more peaceful with this guy. And by the way, that's the rub,
yeah,
by the way.
If you like to sit down and talk with those guys, yeah.
You you say in that song introduction, and by the way, you put it very eloquently, whether someone agrees with you or not, you say that never has the enemy been more invisible or the cost of preserving our freedom been so high. That sounds like we have to trade more of our civil liberties and freedoms to protect ourselves. That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, no, it doesn't mean we trade them. It means we defend them. And at some point, as those of us who've lived, I think maybe you too, through other conflicts, realize free people voluntarily suspend some of their liberties to defend themselves. I remember during a couple of our conflicts where we had to, well, we not only rationed gas, but all kinds of things, sugar and all kinds of things, and we shut off our lights at night, and we do things that inhibit ourselves because it's to defend our families. And so, and then you go back to hopefully to living normally later after you've paid the price to defend your liberties. If you don't, if you want to keep your liberties and all your civil liberties and expect your enemy to respect them as well, you're going to be in for some serious trouble, as we've already found out.
Pat Boone, you still live in Beverly Hills?
live in Beverly Hills, right in the epicenter.
Do you, yes, do you still live next to Ozzy Osbourne? Has he moved?
No, he did move, yes. We were neighbors for 3 years, and then I'm sort of grateful that he and Sharon and the kids moved to a different location just before they started their television show. But, of course, many times on their show, you heard Ozzy say, the best bleep, bleep, bleep neighbor we ever had. And I think it's because we were the only neighbors that never called the police, but we got along great. I really like him and Sharon and the kids, and happy to say that Jack and Kelly they're turning out to be real productive citizens. I was worried about them for a while.
Yeah, that's right. Now, didn't Kelly go through rehab? And
yeah, so did Jack.
They both did, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now, he's a physical specimen. My, he's into martial arts, and he's trimmed down, and he's quite a guy. We may see him on World Wrestling before long.
Mm. Now, Pat, you don't... and by the way, I want to ask you a little about Billy Graham in a minute, too. We'll come back to that. But
yeah. You
don't have to work, obviously. You've got sold 45 million records. You live in Beverly Hills.
Oh, I'm a fortunate guy. Yeah,
you're very fortunate. You put the fortune in fortunate. So you must just do everything you do because you love it at this point.
I do. In fact, that's almost... a problem, because I, you know, long since arrived at a place in my life where whatever I imagine or dream of or want to do, I can go ahead and initiate. And and you know, that's what happened with the metal album. It's what's happened with many of my activities, and of course the tribute to Billy Graham is one I worked on for several years, and now the For My Country, the Ballad of the National Guard. I just felt like in the time of the Vietnam War, when the anti-war sentiment was very much the same, and with good reason, but the people were saying, well, we hate the war, but we support the troops. Well, the troops don't feel much support in that kind of a environment, and I've got a Marine friend in Iraq right now, 6'5", and a wonderful guy I've known since he was a little boy. And he says, Pat, he can call me because he's in communications, and he says, we get more support from the Iraqi people than we feel we get from our own American people. And he said,
well, you've got to take away the television. That's all.
Take away the television?
Take away their television, yeah.
Well, not just television. I mean, they get the news and they get letters and they get all kinds.
I mean, you've got to cut them off from all communication. Then they'll feel great.
Yeah, because they're over there doing something that they volunteered to do. They are combating an enemy on their soil instead of New York and Washington and Pennsylvania and Seattle. And they're heading off an enemy that, as we said, it's not a country. It's a mindset. It's a terrorist mentality that is determined that everybody's going to bow to their idea of a theocratic rule, or we will die. And they hate us just because we're not them.
And we sure appreciate what they're doing over there, Pat. I'm interested to watch this History of the National Guard DVD because my father was a veteran of the National Guard, the Mississippi National Guard. My uncle was a career National Guard person. He just retired. But I think one of the reasons they joined the National Guard back when they did was...
so they could stay here.
To stay in Mississippi and do work there. Is there been other times in our nation's history when the National Guard has had to go overseas to fight?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, the Second World War in particular. But, I mean, when Roosevelt called up, had to put, you know, call up the Army, the first line of defense then and always... is the National Guard. They've had training. When they signed up, they knew they might be called up, and they are. And they leave their dentist offices and their real estate offices and their other professions.
Real estate office is pretty quiet anyway these days.
Yeah, there's not much going on there.
Casey.
There's going on there, too. But they wind up being our first line of defense, not only overseas, but when there's a flood, an earthquake, a riot. You know, they're there. The National Guard is our first line. They're volunteer. It's the volunteer army, and so there's never been a tribute to them.
Pat, I noticed that you've been married for over 50 years.
Yeah,
and I am about ready to start a marriage. How the heck have you made it last that long?
Well, you know, I could make up joking answers, but truthfully, it certainly helps to have vetted your mate and not just act on some impulse. I mean, surely not.
Just like a vice presidential candidate?
Yeah, you got to really bet her.
Yeah, really, you better. You better know what you're going to get, and also the family of that person, and you know, feel like you've got a lot in common, not just the physical attraction. But Shirley and I, you know, we dated from the time we were 16 till we married at 19. And so we knew each other really well. And then we made commitments, not just to each other, but to God, because we consider marriage a holy thing.
And wow, 16 and 19. I looked at your eyes bug out at that.
I didn't say anything.
Nobody does that today, right?
It's crazy.
Yeah. That's young, but that's that was my dad's generation.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what you did. You married young, right?
And besides, for us, this sounds naive, but it's real. For us, during the time between 16 and 19, holding hands and Shirley let me put my arm around her and hold her close, and that first little kiss after we dated for 9 months.
Whoa! I am in trouble.
But I mean, there was that period of time when the anticipation, as Carly Simon once sang, was magnificent, and you go through a period where you get to know each other well, and there's that tension and that anticipation, but you're getting to know each other in other ways than just physical, and you better do that, because after a while the physical will lose some of its
luster,
early excitement. It better be more
elasticity.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Say, Pat, what an interesting thing you bring up there, because culturally now we have shifted. We don't get married usually till mid-20s at the earliest, late 20s and early 30s. And, you know, it's unreasonable to ask people who are going through hormonal explosions to remain chaste all of that time. But in your era, 16, 17, you really did just hold hands, and it was amazing just to be near a person and feel that person's warmth and breath. Do you think that we should get back to encouraging people to marry younger, or has society just changed so much? How would we adapt? Should churches relax the whole, the whole chastity thing? It's not working that well these days, you got to admit.
That's not the answer, because the negative fallout from all the promiscuity. You know, I've got four daughters, so we talked about this in depth a lot as they were sorting out what they were going to do. And I can truthfully tell you that all four daughters came to their mates, married after 20, as late as 24, came to their mates, and they were the only ones that they ever were physically intimate with.
Really?
And that's something to be said for entertainers' family and living in Hollywood. But it's because we did talk things through thoroughly, and we examined the options, and we talked about the fact that you know, intimate relation, sex, is one of the big glues that keeps a couple together. Well, if you waste all of that before you even married, as so many people do,
if you leave the top off the glue and it gets hardened, it's not there when you need it to hold the relationship together.
That's exactly the right. Plus, you have associations that were, you know, of forbidden, guilty kind of excitement. And so after the new wears off in the marriage, you think, well, hey, I'd like to have some of what I experienced in high school or college.
And it was like guilty. It was guilty, forbidden pleasure. And that makes guilty, forbidden pleasure good later.
You want to go back to that. It haunts you and tempts you. And, you know, and plus the disease and the pregnancies and the mental penalties.
You should do one of them For My Country albums for this stuff. Do the whole chastity album.
Leave it in your pants.
No, like, you know what I mean? Like the guy who did the sunscreen song. You could take that sunscreen song and just
save it for marriage.
Yeah.
Well, honestly, you know, I have written about it a lot, not musically. Well, I don't know. I've recorded a lot of songs that talk about, real love, but I also did some pro-life songs and videos pleading for the unborn child, which is one of the negative fallouts of of the promiscuous lifestyle these days.
And the book, The Little Talk Before the Big Talk, A Parent's Guide to Shame-Free Sex Talk. You endorsed that. What's that all about? The Little Talk Before the Big Talk, A Parent's Guide to Shame-Free Sex Talk. Somebody told me that you were you had endorsed that book.
They list him as an endorser on
a new book?
I'm not quite sure. I actually, that one takes me by surprise because I'm not quite clear what that relates to. But I am always for folks who are promoting marriage in its traditional and intended mode, and it's the way that works, and the fallout from trying all the other ways is getting heavier and heavier all the time, right, with the broken marriage statistics. People that live together a while and then get married have a lot less chance of staying together than if they'd gotten married and then lived together. You
Pat
know?
Boone in Beverly Hills. Pat, how are you, like, does it bother you that Ellen DeGeneres is going to be able to get married now in your state?
Well, I'm sad about it, actually, because, you know, I have, in this business that I'm in, and for 50 years, I have a lot of homosexual friends, men and women.
You have to. You live in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
I mean, I work with...
I don't think how you could ever get a party catered without having some,
well,
you know...
That's right.
Or throw any kind of a musical production. Yes.
My hairstyle, for Pete's sake, or whatever.
For Pete's sake, yes. Okay.
But anyway, yes, had lots of dear friends. I've already lost friends, visitors in hospitals as they were dying of AIDS. And I know the statistics of suicide and depression and all these things.
You know, all of that stuff. Then why wouldn't a good, committed relationship like a marriage be good for them, too?
Well, I'm not saying a relationship for some can't be satisfying, but the statistics, the overwhelming statistics show that that these unions are not nearly as permanent as traditional marriage. Plus, the main thing is I'm concerned about is that marriage has always been between one man and one woman, and it ought to stay that way. Other arrangements can have different names and different, I mean, they can have all those.
Well, often marriage is between one man and three different women and one woman and six different guys. And, I mean, marriage, if you believe the statistics, hasn't stayed together very well at all.
Polygamy, as you just described.
No, I didn't describe polygamy. I mean, not at the same time.
Divorces.
But with divorce and remarriage, it's not like marriage can say, look, we have this perfect institution. We don't want you to wreck it.
But at least when people go into traditional marriage, they don't say, I pledge to honor and obey or whatever, support three more people. They go into a marriage between one other person and themselves.
Yes,
and they hope it will last. But you know, that we're having to fight for just basic things like the definition of marriage under God and our pledge, whether or not school kids can voluntarily say a prayer if they want to. I mean, the traditional guideposts and underpinnings of our society are really under attack because there are some people who just don't want any restrictions on anything.
All right. So your friends who are, as you say, homosexual, you love them and you want them to be happy, though.
Yes, I do.
And it's sort of a don't ask, don't tell kind of a deal as far as whatever they do. You'd rather not have it formalized. It's just out of curiosity.
Well, no, it's not not that I don't want it formalized. They can do what they want and what the civil unions, for example, other formats.
Could they have all the same civil rights and just not use the word marriage, and would that be okay?
Well, I'm not in favor of taxpayer funding it, no.
Let's tax the heck out of them, the gay people.
Oh, no,
all right.
I didn't say tax the heck. No, you're putting words in my mouth.
Tax them up the yin-yang. I do use phrases, but all right, let me get to a couple other quick things because we're running out of time with you. Billy Graham, a man you would admire tremendously.
Yes.
This entire album is all about him. It's a tribute to him. Thank you, Billy Graham.
Yes, I think without any question, surely, one of the most significant human beings since the very first century in terms of the benefits and the impact, favorable impact he's had on millions and millions of people in person as well as on television and through all other media outlets in terms of eternal benefit, not just temporal. And the man is still with us, and he's humble, he's been so effective and dynamic, and I just think we need to pay honor to those whom honor is due when When Mother Teresa died, her funeral and commemoration was rather buried in the all the sorrow about Princess Diana's.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
it was at the same time, and I thought then, see, what's going to happen when Billy Graham moves upstairs? Is there going to be a big World Cup, a big earthquake, a tsunami, a scandal? Is something going to bump him off the news when he's entitled to a great, great tribute? And why wait till then? Let's honor him while
we're doing it while he's alive. All right, Pat, two quick Wikipedia true-false questions.
Yeah.
I love to bust the myths here. It says here that you wanted to change your version of Ain't That a Shame to Isn't That a Shame so that children wouldn't get poor grammatical influence from the song title. True-false?
That is true. I had just enrolled at Columbia University and was majoring in English. Not accepted usage then.
Isn't that a shame?
Isn't that a shame?
Right. All right, second one. Reportedly, you declined to play in a film opposite Marilyn Monroe because of her kind of a less than pristine image.
No, it's true and false. I did turn down, on risk of suspension, the movie they wanted me to play. Not, but I wanted to play a movie with Marilyn Monroe, but the storyline was a very immoral storyline. And I felt it would be a tremendous bad influence on my teenage fans, and so I said, I can't do it. Give me something else to, you know, some other story. They went ahead and made it with Joanne Woodward and Richard Beamer, and it was a colossal bomb. So maybe
there you go. You've got that. You've got that golden touch. 45 million albums, Pat Boone in Beverly Hills. Pat, we are going to put links to your albums on our website, and we thank you again for saying hi to us.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciated it. It's invigorating.
We just talked to Pat Boone. Probably the third or fourth time, I think.
That's about right.
He, Joe was poo-pooing him. You didn't, you were trying to bust him on that book.
I wasn't trying to bust him. I was reading in the stuff that Mike sent out because we were talking about youth and, you know, when, you know, saving it and all that. And it said he had endorsed a book that had just come out.
That came from Mike's Prep, right?
Yeah. And it was called, let's see if I have it here.
The Little Talk Before the Big Talk?
The Little Talk Before the Big Talk, A Parent's Guide to Shame-Free Sex Talk.
So we when we mentioned it to Pat Boone, he just said,
that's news to me.
That's news to me. And then Joe did a little research online, and the press release just came out
4 days ago. And the headline is, Pat Boone says yes to shame-free sex talk. Father's Day is just around the corner. Blah, blah, blah. Here's a book introduced by Pat Boone. I do appreciate the book and its intent and hope my endorsement works, writes Pat Boone. So he's endorsing a book that he doesn't know about. Or somebody.
Well, it could be that his business interests have the right to vet, as he said. Like, for example, Obama isn't going to vet every vice presidential candidate. He'll have a team full of people. You sell 45 million records. You're an enterprise, he is.
Well,
he's got a team of people that look at these endorsement opportunities, and they write a little something up, and it's good.
Does he not remember saying this? Pat Boone adds, I was a young dad of 23 when I graduated from college with four little girls already. Maybe I should have had a little sex education myself. But it has been a delightful and rewarding ride.
You think Pat just, somebody in the office wrote that for Pat?
Actually, Eric, your sister's in PR. Tell them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a situation where they paraphrase what you're going to say. You don't. There's no way that you can possibly go to, for example, Ty Pennington, who's the main guy from Extreme Makeover Home Edition, and get him to personally look over every little thing that they attribute to him.
Shirley and I have 15 grandkids, 10 of them girls as well. We had to learn through trial and error how to communicate vital information like that included in this book to our own
kids.
The more
the deeper you go into this, the more blatant it gets.
Yeah, come on.
But I have to tell you that it's a dirty little secret. It's one of my favorite phrases lately. It's a dirty little secret of PR that a lot of those PR quotes you read are published with permission, but written by somebody else.
Most parents need this kind of help, and it is sure good to have it with the generous helping of humor as well.
It totally sounds like a PR girl's writing.
So if somebody gets to say that Pat Boone should, I should have had some sex education. Four daughters by the time I was 23.
I think they went a little too far with it.
Maybe. Hey, I wish I'd have killed a few lambs and got some lambskin condoms to maybe keep me from having 19 grandkids by the time I was 50.
I'd like to email it to him. I mean, if he doesn't know he's endorsing this, he probably should.
I think his business entity probably, I wonder if money ever changes hands. Or could that book have completely made up Pat Boone's endorsement? Doubtful. More likely.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had a few quotes attributed to me that someone wrote it and said, is that okay with you? And I went, yeah, that's fine. I said that. Because that makes it my words if I go, I approve this message. I'm Pat Boone, and someone who works for me approved this message.
So you think somebody made up, I was a young dad of 23 with four little girls. Maybe I should have had some sex education myself. And then
yes.
You go and ask Pat Boone?
Yes, I do.
It's okay if I say that.
Or, look, or you may have me here. Or it may just be that he's getting a little forgetful.
I think that may be it. It's like he had.
How old is Pat Boone?
74.
Man, I could have. 74.
And he came on to talk, you know, the National Guard, Billy Graham,
right.
And we hit him with, you know, the sex talk stuff.
George Chandler said he didn't know that a 2.5-inch nail was driven into his skull until his buddy noticed it through his cap. Chandler said he felt only like a bee sting. It never really did what you call hurt, he says. From Shawnee, Kansas, he's on the phone with us this morning, and he was on the Today Show yesterday. George Chandler, good morning. How are you?
Well, good morning.
Hey, now, everyone, it is said, gets 15 minutes of fame. Was this worth it?
Yes, now that it's over with and now that I know it didn't hurt. But I don't think I could take a gun and shoot myself like that and just for the fame.
No, just for the fame, yes.
No.
Just to meet someone, Meredith Vieira or whatever her name is.
Who was the girl on the show yesterday? Ann Curry. Ann Curry did the interview.
You talked to Ann Curry?
Yeah.
I might take a nail to the head to meet Ann Curry.
Yeah.
I got to tell you.
Yeah, she's a very nice lady.
Now, Joe gave me a little background here. You didn't know you had to nail. Plus, when you got to the hospital, they weren't all that helpful, and then they took it out in an unusual way. Let's start with the moment it happened. Set the scene for us. Tell us what you were doing and how that moment happened and what you thought.
Okay, first of all, we were just putting lattice up, and we were down to about the last two boards of putting the lattice up. And Phil was... The guy that was helping me was kindly on a 3-foot ladder, and I was on the ground, and the cord on the air compressor got caught, and he yanked on the cord to try to untangle it. When he did that, he come forward, and about that time, I stood up a little bit, and it just grazed my head. It was just enough that made the gun go off. And actually, I thought maybe the nail just flickered off my head, because I really didn't feel anything but a little sting. And I asked Phil, George, where'd the nail go? I said, well, I don't know, but I said, look up here and see if it just scratched the top of my head. And he said, oh, there it is. So then he kindly panicked, and he called 911, and of course the ambulance came, and they set me down.
What words did he use to tell you the nail was in your head? Did he let out a gasp or a scream, or did he
found it?
He says, the goddamn thing's in your head.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for cleaning that up for us.
Yeah, clean that up for me, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So he gave you the bad news. And now, does he must feel awful. This is, well, it's not...
Sure, you know, he did, and of course he panicked, and he had 911 on the call, and he was pacing back on the deck, and we have a fence out there, and he was opening the fence, so the gate, so he could watch the street and keep an eye on me, because every once in a while he'd say, just sit there, don't move, because the first thing I wanted to do, because I didn't know the nail was into the hat, and I was trying to take my hat off, and I couldn't get the hat off, because the hat was nailed in.
The hat was nailed in, yeah. Now, at this moment, do you panic at all? It sounds like he's more worried than you are.
Yeah, he panicked more than I did. And then when the ambulance got there, they kind of put a neck brace on me, and they put the backboard on me, and of course, you know, it seemed like there was millions of people just looking over the top of my head, and I was looking at directly in the sun. And I told that guy, I said, you know, I don't feel good. And I did black out for about 5 seconds. And then I come back, and then I was fine. I got in the ambulance and the driver, and we talked all the way. And I heard the little lady in there. She called the hospital and gave the vital signs. And we got there. They got me out. And the first thing they told me to do was we're going to take a CAT scan. And I said, okay, and they laid me in there and told me to lay still, and they talked to me while I was in there. And
they keep talking to you, don't they?
Yeah, they keep talking, and they don't really ask a lot of, they like your Social Security, your birthday, your name, you know, just minor things that they know that, you know, that you're still with them. And anyway, when they get the CAT scan, the doctor read the CAT scan as soon as it was ready, and I guess he made a decision right then that it wasn't near as bad as it could be, and they had a motorcycle accident ahead of me, and he said that he had to go into that surgery first, and then he would get to me.
That's the part I couldn't believe, that they bumped you back a couple of patients. I thought nailing the head would get you pretty quick treatment.
Well, I thought so too. At the
what
time.
Do I got to do?
It kind of made me feel a little better that I wasn't, at least I wasn't the worst patient in there.
That's a good point.
Or could we possibly give a shout out to your HMO?
Yeah. Make sure you got insurance, buddy.
Yeah. What kind of insurance do you have?
Our insurance, is it Prudential? Cigna.
Cigna. All right. Let's give him a shout out. Yeah. You'll be number two.
Number two. And anyway, so they took me up to my room, and they let everybody come in two at a time, and they come in and everybody talked to me. My sister finally come up there, and my daughters and everybody, my nephews. And
so they all got a look at you with the nail still in your head?
Yeah.
Do you want your family to see that?
Well, I actually couldn't see it, you know.
Yeah.
Just a hard look on their face.
Do they? Yeah. Does each one freak out when they see it, though?
No, they. After they.
You really enjoy the attention, don't you?
Yeah. After they notice that I'm able to talk and move my hands and my arms, my legs and my eyes, and you know, they ask me. I said, well, I just have just a slight sting or a slight headache, but it's like, you know, when you read a lot and your eyes hurt a little bit. That's about what it felt like.
Wow. So you went into surgery.
Actually, we never did go into surgery. The doctor come into my room, and he said, no, George, we're going to pull that nail out. And I said, all right. And so I thought, well, we're going to wheel right down to the operating room. He said, no, I'm going to do it right in this room. So he said,
whoa. Pulls out a claw hammer.
Well,
what was your insurance company again?
He gets a pair of pliers out.
A pair of pliers?
A pair of pliers, and he's trying to get a hold of the head of the nail, and he can't quite get it. He keeps slipping off, and I keep hearing that bang, and I think, God dang. And then he looked at me and says, well, George, he says, I need a claw hammer. I said, oh,
no.
A claw hammer. He said, yeah. He said, I think I can get it out with a claw hammer. So I said, well, I'm sure some of my friends that are out there, probably somebody's got a claw hammer. And so he went out there, and the maintenance for the hospital gave him a claw hammer and a screwdriver, and he poured some disinfections in it, and he got the screwdriver, and he pried the nail up just enough that he slipped that hammer and right out. I know it sounds terrible. It really didn't hurt. I mean, it just a little sting.
And then once now you have a hole in your head.
Yeah, I've got four staples up there holding that, and I got to go back and see him, I think, Friday.
All right, but the part of the brain that this nail went into, nothing you were using, obviously.
Yeah, actually, they said just millimeters away, it missed the one for the eyesight, it missed the one for the right side, and the one that carries the fluid for your spinal cord fluid, you know, and it missed that, and it was fine.
So which part of your brain, did he tell you, like, what it did hit, what you could expect?
Only thing they do right now with the brain when it has a drama is there's a chance that you can have seizures. And they got me on some seizure medicine, and they said that'll last about 3 or 4 months. And I think a week from today or a week from yesterday, I got to go back for another CAT scan so they can check it out.
And I assume that nail is a family heirloom. You'll probably
I've got it in my little carrying case, and you're not going to believe this, but I got back yesterday, and there was a message from Ripley's, believe it or not, and they would like to buy the nail.
For how much?
Well, I don't. They didn't say. They just said they would call me back.
Sure. George Chandler, Shawnee, Kansas. George, congrats. I'm glad you're well, and you may now resume your regular life.
Yep, and I appreciate you guys calling.
Take care.
Thanks.
I still want to meet him in person, but he is in town, and he is on the phone. Award-winning author Salman Rushdie, we've spoken with him before, known as one of the world's most important living storytellers. The fact that he's living at all is quite a story in itself. Rushdie has published 9 previous best-selling novels, including The Satanic Verses, which you may remember got put out a fatwa on his head. It'll never escape him. Probably the people who put it out forgot it, but no, none of us in the media ever will. Shalimar the Clown is another one of his books, Midnight Children. He has just published his 10th work of fiction. It's called The Enchantress of Florence. Salman Rushdie, welcome back to the Bob Rivers Show.
Hi, nice to be back.
So we've already done the whole talk about the past thing with you. Let's start with how you're doing today.
I'm doing pretty well. I mean, here I am in Seattle and it's not raining.
Yeah, and would you stay, please? Because you apparently bring some sort of magic insulation from fatwa and rain.
You wouldn't have been able to say that any other day the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, I know. I heard about that.
All right. Do you get to Seattle often?
I've been kind of half a dozen times, I guess. Yeah. Unfortunately, I've never been here in any kind of leisurely way. I've always been kind of rushing through on book tour.
That's why you put the rush in Rushdie, right?
Yeah, thank you for that.
Have you now, as an author, I want to ask this, and we're going to get to this book, the new book, but as an author writing books, and these are considered quite excellent literature. These are not the kind of things that I would buy and read in 2-hour novels. But I'll be honest, I haven't read one of your books yet. Now I feel like I really have to, as I've talked to you 3 times.
You should have a go at this one.
I should have a go at it? Okay.
Because what I'm being told about this one is that it's probably the most, accessible book that I've written. And I think, because it's a kind of historical novel, and it's a kind of fable, and it's a love story, and so on. And so people seem to be finding this one... it's a beach read, I'm told, by one of the critics.
Ah, well.
so you don't have to be as smart to read this one.
Yeah.
It's kind of what...
Can it be a cloudy day read?
I think it could be a cloudy day read.
All right,
yeah.
Well, then we'll get to it. Now, before you start to write a book, how much research do you have? I mean, how much stuff do you already know, and how much do you have to literally go to work and dig up things to put in the book to make it have depth and be authentic?
Well, I mean, sometimes you don't have to do any at all, but because not all books are kind of historically based. I mean, sometimes you're just writing about a world you know about. But this one, because it all takes place 400 years ago between the Mughal Empire in India and the Renaissance in Florence and kind of everything in between as well, I really had to give myself a crash course not just in the history of the period, that's quite easy to get hold of, but kind of the ordinary life and the interesting little details and the stuff that actually brings the past to life.
Wow. And just to get us a little excited about this book, tell us just a couple of interesting things about living, and you say it's in India?
Well, partly in India, partly in Florence.
All right. What would be a couple of interesting day-to-day life things that you would have noticed living 400 years ago?
Well, one of the things that happened, actually interestingly happened in both Europe, in both Florence and India in this period, is that rich families, aristocratic families, basically locked up their daughters. You know, the daughters were kept indoors, and there were arranged marriages to make sort of treaties between one powerful family and the other, and they weren't out there kind of having romances with boyfriends. And as a result, in both worlds, young men being what they are, men had to seek their pleasures elsewhere. And so the phenomenon of the courtesan grew in both worlds. And there were these ladies of easy virtue holding these grand salons where the wittiest men and the most beautiful women and the greatest musicians and so on would all come. And they were like exclusive clubs.
So these were people's daughters who were not locked up.
These were.
And the world's oldest profession was certainly not born then, but it was alive and thriving.
And very odd that it should happen in the same way in two different cultures thousands of miles apart at exactly the same time.
Hmm. And now the women that were locked up, were they used as to marry for power, families to families? Like
essentially, they were used as kind of pawns in sort of alliances between the great families.
Is this a love story between specific people? What's it about?
Yeah, it's a love story about this Indian princess who gets captured by, you know, a rival warlord, and then he gets defeated, and she gets bounced from, kind of, if you like, king to king across the face of the earth until she's rescued by an Italian soldier of fortune in Turkey, actually, and they fall in love, and he brings her back to Italy.
Now, that sounds like a lot of fun. So I can learn about a whole different time in history and get a nice love story. And as a bonus, there's nothing in this book that's going to put a price on your head.
I don't think so. There's just a price on the book.
That's it.
So, I mean, I have a young daughter, and I read to her every night. And I was this a good book I can read to my young daughter? I tried the Satanic Verses that gave her bad dreams.
I wouldn't do that. How young is she?
She's 5.
No, I think there's too much sex in it.
Okay. You, my friend, know how to sell a book.
That's right.
Too much sex in there.
That's very good. Salmon, tell us a little bit, if you would, about your day-to-day living. You know, we talked about 400 years ago, day-to-day living. Mm. What does Salman Rushdie do? Do you have a little garden? I always picture authors as having a quiet little place somewhere.
Do they tend
a little garden, and they're inspired in a little writing room with maybe a nice window?
I have a very nice writing room. I mean, I have a place in New York and a place in London, so I kind of go between the two. And I mean, I have a beautiful...
But you're city, not country.
I'm very much a city boy. Okay. I mean, I'm of the view that the countryside is for cows.
Ah.
And actually, what I like most is for my friends to have places in the country so I could go and visit them and then run away 2 days later.
Now, since the last time we spoke, you have been knighted. Are you now Sir Salman Rushdie?
I am technically, yes, but you don't have to do that.
Don't have to call you sir.
No, you don't have to. In fact, please don't.
I don't want to bring up the past, but is the fatwa still in place?
No, really. I mean, I think at this stage it's essentially a media fatwa. I mean, it's the only...
That's right. It's not. That's what I said at the intro.
Is it fair to say that you've benefited tremendously from that attention?
God, I don't know. I wouldn't recommend it. You want to have 9 years of your life screwed up, that would be the thing to do. It doesn't feel like benefit to me.
It's like being Ozzy's kid. It comes with a lot of baggage. Eric, go ahead.
Mr. Rushdie, how do you see relations evolving between the West and the Islamic countries now?
Well, I mean, it's a difficult time right now, but I think I myself always believed that this phenomenon of extremism, of radicalism, is a relatively short-lived phenomenon. I think, you know, if we were to talk again in 30 or 40 years' time, which I certainly won't be, I think it will be seen to have been a phase rather than some kind of new long-term thing. But that doesn't mean it's not dangerous and worrying, because, you know, 30 years may be a short time in the eye of history, but it's a long time in an ordinary life.
Mm. And the world is... we just recently traveled to Africa on a mission. The world is still not all, you know, modernized. There's some dramatic shifts and changes happening right now that it's sort of odd for us. We're in a sort of an insular situation here. We don't really... we're not really often aware of hundreds of years of oppression and things that have happened elsewhere.
I mean, one of the things about researching this book is to discover that in a way, you know, human beings, we've always been up to the same stuff. You know, we're not a peaceful species. I mean, if we think we're in the middle of brutal wars now, well, boy, they were brutal then. You know, if we think that torture is a problem now, they tortured people much more violently than we ever do now. So when you look at the past, what you see is, I mean, it's not hard to see a mirror of yourself, you know, because we are what we are, and this is the kind of animal we are.
Without revealing too much about the plot of your book, The Enchantress of Florence, can you be a kept, locked-up woman and then traded to somebody's family and be happy?
Well, not really. And I think the thing that interested me about her in the story is that she kind of escapes from that world, and she tries, you know, she's trying to make her own life. She actually chooses for love in the end. She chooses this Italian guy, not because it's kind of, you know, a good alliance, but because she falls in love with him. So in a way, she's moving from that world of the woman as pawn to a woman trying to make her own choices.
Salman Rushdie. A lot of books, 10. This is his 10th, and a beach read.
Salman, I made a joke about reading this book to my kid, but have you ever thought of writing a book for children? I mean,
yeah,
if you're going to change...
I've written one, actually. I mean, if you wanted to read a book to your kid, there's a book I wrote for my son when he was 10 years old called Haroon and the Sea of Stories.
Okay.
And that's, I would suggest, is slightly more appropriate. And actually, I now have another. My younger son is now just turned 11, and he's going, where's my book?
You haven't, but you didn't write One Fish, Two Fish, Muslim Fish, Jew Fish. That wasn't you?
That was not me.
Okay.
That was another person.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Spike. Simon, thanks for being with us, and we'll check it out. Have a good day.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Meet me in St. Louis, Louis, meet me at the fair. Don't tell me.
A $46 billion unsolicited offer for Anheuser-Busch from foreigners. How would people in St. Louis react to that? Here's Dan at the Highway Bar, St. Louis, Missouri. Dan, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Are your people upset?
Yeah, we got them all riled up now. You can hear all kinds of stuff about it.
And now you heard about, you know all the details?
Excuse me?
You know all the details?
Yeah, we read it. It's on the on the front page of the newspaper, laying on the bar.
Right. The company that is buying them is located in Azerbaijani. Do you know how to spell that?
I can't even spell Azerbaijani.
You can't even spell it, and that's where they're going.
Can't even spell Johnny.
Can't even spell Johnny. Well, you've been open for a few hours, right?
Yeah.
Now, do you know why they decided to locate in Azerbaijani?
No, I do not.
Because they wouldn't have to change the logo. A, B, Azerbaijani.
They wouldn't have to change the logo, guys.
Oh, well, hell.
That A, B still
hell.
Works, yeah.
Tell them, Azerbaijani is A, B.
Yeah, A, B. Well, everybody calls it A, B here.
They do call it A, B.
Yeah, I mean, A, B is like, from this bar, you can stand on the front sidewalk and look at it.
All right.
Now you know, the Azerbaijani workforce averages 12 years of age because they use child labor laws that are really lax.
Right.
What do you think about kids having to make the beer?
Kids making beer.
They employ from 8-year-olds to 14-year-olds in most of the breweries in Azerbaijani.
12 to 8 years old.
Yeah.
Making beer in Azerbaijan. Well, you guys were in the wrong country, weren't you?
I'm telling you. I could have been drunk and go long time.
It's gorgeous. Uh-huh. So, now, tell me
you
how
guys
important...
are all getting applications out. Hold on.
Tell me how important...
Get their kids.
How important is Budweiser to St. Louis?
Well, that's the primary beer in this bar. We sell more of that product in this bar than anything.
Do you happen to know how many people work for AB?
How many people work next door, guys?
A couple thousand.
Now, are your clients guys who make beer all day and then they come over there to have one?
Oh, yeah.
Is there anyone sitting at your bar right now who works for Anheuser-Busch?
No.
No one there who works for it because they're at work right now?
No, you won't see them until like 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
Got it. And now, how did you guys hear the news? I imagine it's the biggest story in St. Louis.
Well, it's plastered all over the front page of the newspaper. No, they don't like it. Of course, you know, it's probably good for the brewery, but it's not good for it. What's it going to do for the employees? Is it a good deal? It's going to screw the employees. Look at all these guys that got their whole lives invested in the brewery.
Well, I can't imagine they'll keep that brewery open. They'll be making that beer overseas.
Well, it would be cheaper to make it overseas, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I've invested in Anheuser-Busch.
So how many people you figure this whole town's derived around that?
Yeah.
Now, being a block...
Soulard St. Louis is all AB people.
All right.
Being a block from the source there, how much is a pitcher of AB in your bar during happy hour?
We don't sell it by the pitcher, but a bottle of beer is $1.75.
Wow.
That's not bad, not bad.
And then this is the home of the dollar beer, the highway bar. That's $1 for a natty.
All right, we're going to say goodbye to you guys now. Can you do me a favor? Have everybody in the bar boo this purchase. Just hold up the phone and say, everybody give a big boo to the takeover of Budweiser by Azerbaijani.
I got it. All right.
Everybody, a boo for this purchase.
Boo.
All four of them.
Thank you very much. All four.
I love the guy in the background.
Dan at the Highway Bar across from Anheuser-Busch.
I've been investing in Budweiser for years. Dollar a time.
Thank you, buddy. Be well.
That's Boo. Oops.
They did not even begin to question Azerbaijan.
And you know, they're going to leave here and go out there. You know, they hired 8-year-old.
We're starting rumors.
The story's going to spread like wildfire.
Can we, let's What country should we use next? Yes, Eric.
It's Azerbaijan.
I knew.
Yeah,
yeah,
whatever.
Okay,
whatever. It's Belgium, actually, but who's picking it?
How about North Korea? North Korea buys Budweiser.
Ooh. Yeah, the deal was that Kim Jong-il had one once, and he loved it.
Ah,
he
that's good.
By the company.
That's
yeah.
good. Okay, hang on.
You just going to call the same guy? He probably won't remember.
Did you hear?
Change the name to Mikarobe.
All right. All right, hand it to me. You got to push the button. Hotline. Hello? Yes, is this the King of Cars, King Dodge Chrysler Jeep? You used to be?
Uh-oh.
Oh, it's Don Brown Dodge Chrysler Jeep now. Okay. Is it still the King of Cars? Oh, the reason I ask is it's CBS Radio in Seattle calling. We're just getting some random comments on the Budweiser sale to foreign interests, and we wanted to maybe find someone there who likes Budweiser to talk to us. Got anybody hanging around that likes Budweiser? All right. Could you get someone? All right. Thank you. All right. Hang on. Put it on hold now. And then I put it. Now that I have permission. Wait a minute. I don't have his permission. Give me
you got the receptionist. You got Myrtle Hello? At the front desk to say okay.
Hang on one second.
Well, I'm just... Everything is lawyers now. You know what I'm talking about. I just want to make sure it's okay.
This is the king in, please.
The king of cars has been sold to Don Brown.
Don Brown of Uzbekistan.
Who's this? Darwin? Did you say Darwin? Oh, hi. This is Bob Rivers calling from CBS Radio in Seattle. We're just making some random calls to get some feedback on the sale of Budweiser to foreign interests. You got like 30 seconds to say hi on the radio? Is anybody there that can? All right, thanks. He's getting a peon.
Let me get you back to the service department. Hey, you guys drink beer? Okay.
At first I thought we were being blown off because, you know, we don't talk to the media, but
right. No,
I'm too important to talk to the media. That's good. She must have gone for the boss.
Now you see what I go through every time you say, let's call someone in.
Oh, I know.
Got a better chance of getting Belgium on the line.
Let's see how long it takes for him to find someone unimportant enough to talk to us.
I got two more taverns. They are passionate about the story at taverns, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I know. These guys, it might be hard to get them to believe a different country.
Right.
Try it anyway.
Yeah, really. Hans Briggs.
Oh, it could be a while. For those of you that just tuned in, an unsolicited all-cash offer for Budweiser shares, which... closed at about $58 on Wednesday. The bid is $65. We've just been through this with Microsoft. Yes, hello. You're having a hard time finding somebody? All right, I'll hold. Boy, at least they're trying.
No kidding.
And we went through this with Microsoft. Yeah. And as it turned out, Yahoo has not yet been bought by Microsoft. But someone else, Carl Icahn? Is it... Corporate raider is doing his own hostile takeover attempt. And meanwhile, when that sort of thing happens, they put in things called poison pills at company. Do you know what those are?
No.
Oh, hold on. She's back. Yes? No one can talk to us. All right. Thank you very much. That's all right. Thank you. You know what? I think I was just punked.
How do you mean?
Well, actually, they could have kept that going for another hour.
Yeah, hold on.
I'm listening to these guys on the internet. Come on over here. Put them on hold.
Let me find somebody in parts for you. Hold on.
All right, shall I try Milo's Tavern?
Yeah, sure.
Hang on. Taverns will always say hi.
Tell them if the sale goes well, they're going to buy the arch.
A lot of commentary right now.
A lot of radio stations calling Milo's Tavern. Try this one. Babe's Tavern. All right, go ahead and pick it up. Hello? Yes, is this Babe's Tavern? Oh, Milo's Tavern. I'm sorry. I meant to call you. How are you today? Good. It's Bob Rivers from CBS Radio in Seattle calling. We're just calling randomly some folks to get some reaction to the Budweiser takeover story, where Budweiser is being purchased by a foreign interest. Can you say hi to us on the radio for just a second? It'll only take a minute. Hang on 1 second. Hang on.
Okay.
Milo.
Hi, are we there?
Oh, I know.
Hello?
Oh man!
Is this
hang up?
You are getting schooled, my friend.
Do you know what I feel like now?
Me?
Telemarketer?
No, I feel like Michael Moore.
Oh, do you really? Hot dog, mustard stains.
Because they say, do they do that too? They say yes.
Yeah.
And then they disappear.
Oh, well, you get all different reactions. Yes, no, right. Are you crazy, or hang up.
And you started that one on a bad foot, announcing, you know, their competition.
Yeah.
Is this Babe Stavern? No, it's Milo Stavern.
All right. Do me a favor. Line someone up. Thank you for the hard work that you do.
Want to call it a tin can? Who do you want to call?
I'm going to try one more. The 1776 Cafe. That's got to be good.
Oh, yeah.
Hold on, let me just dial it.
Yes, go ahead.
We'll say AB up $3.50 a share right now, too.
Is it really?
Yeah.
No. We're sorry. 621-2021 has changed. The new number is area code 531-831-8-0.
All right, I can't do that on the air. Okay. This is a pain.
I know.
All right, you go get somebody for me.
Yeah, let's
do what I was doing.
Do what you do so well. Yeah, it worked.
And Mike's irritated because I'm always asking, well, do they have anybody yet?
How hard can it be to get a guy in a bar to talk about beer?
Especially when you're Luciana. How do you feel about foreigners buying beer?
Angie is at Judy's Corner, St. Louis. Hi, Angie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Just fine.
All right, we're on the radio in Seattle, Washington. We're pretty far away from Anheuser-Busch. We're pretty far away from St. Louis. But it's kind of an American icon.
Yes, it is.
We wanted to ask you, how do you feel about Anheuser-Busch being bought by a North Korean company?
We are very, very unhappy about that. Not only are we afraid that there will be a very big loss of jobs and a downfall in the economy here, because there's a lot of people that are employed there. And if that company, if they decide to move the manufacturing over to a different country, then not only do we lose those jobs, but then we'll have to pay an import tax on the beer.
Now, in spite of all of that, Anheuser-Busch stock is up sharply today, people anticipating maybe making a profit on the buyout. Does that affect a lot of people in St. Louis? Do a lot of you own stock, or is that just the bigwigs and the fat cats?
Well, I'm thinking it's just the bigwigs and the fat cats, because I don't profit from that.
No, that stock price isn't going to do any good. Did you hear how the North Korean takeover was initiated?
I did not, but I understand that for some reason or another, the family of Anheuser-Busch only owned 2.5%
right
of the stock.
Right. It's being controlled by public ownership. So people's immediate greed for $7 a share is going to cost the city of St. Louis thousands of jobs and have this beer made in North Korea.
And as it turns out, Kim Jong-il, you've heard of him, right?
Yes.
He's the dictator of North Korea. He had some Budweiser, like he has sampled so many Western products, and he decided he liked it, and he said, well, let's buy the company.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's ridiculous, because, you know, I mean, I can't believe that people in St. Louis, you know, they're that greedy that they're willing to sell their shares of stock and put their fellow countrymen out of work like that. You know, I mean, it's our economy is already having trouble right now.
Yeah.
And then to put all of these people out of work, and not only the people that work at the plant, but the people who deliver the beer itself. I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of jobs.
And I don't know what you know about North Korea, where Kim Jong-il is president, but his workers are forced to work like 17, 20-hour days.
Right.
I mean, this is a really oppressive government, and they're not paid anything at all.
And children as young as 7 work full-time.
Right, and that's ridiculous.
Can you imagine, will you even drink Budweiser?
No.
You'll stop drinking it.
No, we will. My family and I will move to Miller products.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, geez.
Because, you know, if they are producing these things, I don't believe in that kind of a government myself. And I would not support that now. No.
Weapons of mass destruction and fine lagers all in one factory.
Right. It's really awful.
It's probably the same place they'll make it.
Angie, thank you very much.
Thank you. And you guys have a great day.
All right.
Don't you feel bad?
Not at all.
I hear they're going to buy the Gateway Arch.
Yeah.
And have it moved.
I feel a little bad about that one.
I know, man. I can't drink beer from a country where they make 7-year-olds work 20-hour days.
Well, closer you get to the middle of our country, the more the blurred the rest of the world becomes. I hate to say it, but
the dumber they get.
Well, foreign is foreign, you know.